Sahanavavatu, Sahanabhunaktu, Sahaviryankaravavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Mothering, let me get this right. It's okay. Mothering, nurturing, caregiving. These words bring to mind warmth, love, and generosity. They also evoke expectations, standards, norms, and the need to reconcile one's own identity as a nurturer with other roles outside of the family. There is dissonance in being a mother, nurturer, or caregiver. There are also the unexpected gifts we receive as we seek to accept our own imperfect nurturing and living. Because, contrary to popular opinion, Leave It to Beaver was not a documentary.
Welcome to Seattle. Oh, well, forget that. It's actually Manhattan, Kansas. We welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship on this beautiful, almost spring morning. Let us take a moment to welcome each other and say good morning.
In her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, Brené Brown is a shame and vulnerability researcher. She defines shame. She says, if we want to live in love with our whole hearts, and if we want to engage with the world from a place of worthiness, we have to talk about the things that get in the way, especially shame, fear, and vulnerability. Shame is basically the fear of being unlovable. It's the total opposite of owning our story and feeling worthy. Shame keeps worthiness away by convincing us that owning our stories will lead to people thinking less of us. Shame is all about fear. We're afraid that people won't like us if they know the truth about who we are, where we come from, what we believe, or how much we're struggling. Shame is something we all experience. To feel shame is to be human.
We are born into this world helpless and crying for love. As we grow less helpless, our need for love continues. May each of us receive the love that shapes and sings suppleness into our authentic selves. May we share a love that guides us into the greater wholeness that affirms us all. May this light of our chalice help us find our way, especially when shame and guilt wield more power than love. Now let us stand and sing hymn number 42, Morning So Fair to See. I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service, and there's a correction. On the Finance Committee will meet on May 9th, not May 7th. And in addition to those, we have an announcement for the fellowship dinners. We need a host for the May fellowship dinner. See Jim Chanteau or Ann Martian for information or to volunteer. You set the date and tell guests what to bring, and you choose the number of guests, and space is limited, but it's a great time. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like, please share a brief personal verbal expression of a special joy or sorrow.
My sorrow is my great-grandpa Harry died on Friday morning.
I have a joy. This is Cade Allen. He was born March 26th, so he's just about 6 weeks old. And also my mother is here, so this is Carrie. That's also a joy because she's really helpful with this little guy.
When, on Friday, I saw my very first rainbow, and it was kind of burly, and it was a straight little one.
I have something kind of in the middle. I'm moving, and it's kind of really sad.
Hi, I have a joy that my brother is here.
Welcome. May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. And I would like to add that for those of you who know Jill Jarvis, the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Lawrence, her son died last week, so that congregation is in crisis, as is her entire family. So please extend warm and loving thoughts towards her. Thank you.
morning. How is everybody? Good. Yeah, me too. I know I've read this story to you before, but it kind of fit in with some of the stuff we're talking about today. So does anybody remember when we read this? William, you remember? This is called The Perfect Nest. Okay, we're going to read it together. Jack the Cat gathered together everything he needed, then built the perfect nest, dry and cozy and just the right size. But the nest was not for Jack. With this perfect nest, he would attract a perfect chicken who would lay a perfect egg, which would make a perfect omelet for a cat like Jack. Soon enough, a chicken came along. "Caramba," she cried, "a perfect nest." She hopped up and laid a small egg. Then a duck waddled by. "Sacre bleu," she cried, "the perfect nest." Uh-oh. The duck pushed the chicken out, hopped up, and laid a medium-sized egg. Then a goose lumbered by. "Great balls of fire," she cried, "a perfect nest." Mm-mm. The goose pushed the duck out, hopped up, and laid a large egg. Jack's mouth began to water. Three eggs would make three omelets. But then the duck leaped onto the goose's back. "This is my nest." The chicken flew up onto the duck. "No, this is my nest." The three cackled and quacked and honked, but each refused to leave the perfect nest. They squished each other for days. Crazy birds. Each day, Jack tried to get the birds off of the eggs. "Fire, fire," he cried. They didn't move. "Flood, flood," he cried. They didn't move. "Wolf, wolf," he cried. But the chicken, the duck, and the goose would not move. Finally, Jack stood before them. "You birds are so silly. The next farm over has an even better nest, and it's empty. Why doesn't one of you use that nest?" "An empty nest," cried the chicken, "without a goose to sit on my head? Caramba." "Sacre bleu," cried the duck. "I am tired of smelling like sea chicken. That nest is mine." "Great balls of fire," cried the goose. "Out of my way." And they all flapped away. Alone at last, Jack returned to the nest and peeked inside. He arranged the eggs neatly in a row, a small breakfast, medium lunch, and large dinner. Jack's stomach rumbled, but then, crack! The small egg broke open, and out popped a wet baby chick who looked up at Jack and said, "Caramba, hola, mama." Crackety snap! The medium-sized egg broke open, and out scrambled a wet baby duck who looked up at Jack and said, "Sacre bleu, bonjour, mama." Crackety, crackety, boom. The largest egg broke open, and out stepped a wet baby goose who looked up at Jack and said, "Great balls of fire, howdy, ma." That was not what he had planned. Jack stared at the babies. What was he to do? He couldn't make omelets out of them. Okay, this is where I need your help. Dry me, cried the soggy baby chick. Feed me, feed me, feed me, cried the hungry baby duck. Play, 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 cried the excited baby goose. Jack hid in the barn. The three babies found him. He hid in the woods. The three babies found him. Jack hid under the tractor. The three babies found him and dragged him back to the nest. Here. Sleep, 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 the tired babies finally whispered. Cold, 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 said the shivering babies. Jack scratched his head. Someone had to care for these babies, but there was no one else around. Jack lifted all three babies into the nest. Buenas noches, mama, said the baby chick. Bonne nuit, mama, said the baby duck. Sweet dreams, ma, said the baby goose. Then Jack climbed into the nest, and the babies fell asleep. That's when he realized that this really was the perfect nest. Thanks, Liz.
Go now in peace, may the spirit of
This congregation is a theologically diverse religious community. We are a welcoming congregation to people of all sexual orientations, ethnic, economic, and educational backgrounds. Our membership is open to anyone who desires to belong to a community of mutual caring and to grow as spiritual and moral beings. Our congregation is self-governed by democratic process. A privilege of our free church tradition is to provide all of the financial support for our many ministries from among ourselves. Generosity is one of the spiritual values we recognize as central to our personal and our institutional well-being. You are now invited to share your offering. Thank you. Gifts of imperfection. Loveliness rebels. The Academy teaches me to avoid words like beauty, truth, and love. My mother forbids me at 4 to cross Oak Park. An adult must hold my hand to get to the other side safely. I know not to listen. I march to flowers by gosh. Cross two busy streets to stare at the royal purple gloxinia, to receive all their velvet glory. I know to look both ways, to not let the older boys know how much I need flowers to stay alive, to know life's secrets, what love feels like. Daily, this prairie absorbs the exhaustion that threatens to trap me under the heavy tarp of despair. Beauty nudges random parts of my body like a lover intent for more. I know how the indigo bunting and the scarab beetle betray death, how the butterfly weed becomes such a bold, light, saturated orange, sometimes crimson, the thousands of fireflies coupling on the syringia bush with its sick, sweet, intoxicating fragrance. Cancels defeat. Beauty and its unstoppable motion, not shame or sentimentality, just lovely. How true. And radical. This I still sometimes refuse or hide from. These acts implode, bring me to the edge of doom. But I reach out to touch the lavender, to hold on, to see from winter the red bud burst.
I have always instinctively distrusted statements that romanticize the supposed good old days before women worked outside the home. I didn't have to wonder if women could have families and careers. I knew they could. I was born to a couple in the 1970s who were experimenting, not with anything you might be thinking they were experimenting with, but with what historian Stephanie Kuntz has called the greatest innovation in marriage during the 20th century, the peer-to-peer marriage. If a marriage of equals was indeed revolutionary, my parents were part of that revolution. My mother, who dropped out of college at age 20 to marry my dad, care for her first baby, a son, and work for wages, was encouraged and supported by him to return very soon to college, which she did shortly after my birth when she was 22. My father worked various jobs to support our family. None of them were related to his intellectual background or his aspirations, while my mother moved from top of her class in chemistry to life as a young medical student. She applied to medical school the year I turned 2, 1976. At KU Med, she was told, "We don't think a woman with children fits into our program." She was admitted, however, to the Kansas City College of Osteopathic Medicine and opened her first practice in 1982, the same year my younger brother was born. Let me be clear. My origin story is not one of wealth, feminist triumph, or a rise to power. My parents generally worked like dogs. They had very little family support due to the fact that my mother's parents disowned her for marrying my father, of whom they didn't approve. Their vision for my mom was that she would finish college, become a school teacher, and marry a man with very tidy, materialist values, more like their own. Our house was generally a wreck. We subsisted month to month on my mother's income, a portion of which went to her sizable student loan debt. My brothers and I were the unkempt little rebels of our neighborhood schools. And to be very honest, we grew up in a condition that social workers today would call neglect. But we did have strong family values that ran very deep. Feminism, humanism, and a comfortable paradox promoted by my father. A love of all arts and culture paired with a profound distaste for material consumerism. Many of my memories of my mother are of her exhaustion. Returning home after 38 or even 70-hour shifts, unregulated in those days, especially during her medical residency, completed while I was a middle schooler and high school student. There's also for me a general memory of her warmth, her sarcastic humor, and her attention whenever she could to the little details we cared about as self-absorbed children. I became aware of the 1950s perfect family myth as I matured, as I met the mothers of my high school friends, who even in the 1980s were seeking to be more like June Cleaver than like my mom. But I didn't feel compelled to examine my origin story or the perfect wife-mother myth till I was healing from the dissolution of my first marriage. I married a wonderful, creative person. He suffered from a largely untreated depressive disorder, and eventually he took his own life. Our marriage was already in trouble before he died. Like my parents, we had been juggling breadwinning, child-rearing, and higher education for several years. After becoming a mother during my second year of grad school, I was surprised by my own internal struggle. I adored my little daughter, but I resented that my husband's friends now seemed to regard me differently. I was no longer included in the fun conversations with these guys, all of whom were single and child-free, as they like to call it. I felt like they regarded me as some kind of a lead weight, a voice of motherly reason. These feelings came to a terrible head as we both left graduate school, and for reasons of circumstance and profession, I followed my mother's footsteps to become the sole breadwinner for my family. We had moved to Michigan on a promise of work for my husband, which fell through. After a destitute month without pay, I found a good job, but I was struggling. I was working long hours to keep us in the necessities, and I was feeling guilty that my toddler was away from me all day. In an argument, my husband one night told me that he didn't like my new professional identity, that it was more fun to be with me before we were married, when we were both just artists. Needless to say, my reply involved a few select words, and none of them were particularly kind. In the year after my first husband's death, I wrote these words, thinking back about our circumstances as a young family. Michigan, snow falls straight down, no harsh wind to turn each flake into a scouring particle. Black oak form, branches glaze, top edges white. Blacker still, iron balcony rail. Fragments of tree framed by window rectangle, hazy purple-blue twilight, swaddles, branches outside. Careful crotching from branch to branch ascends to a chaos of fine lines or a profuse order at a smaller scale, dirty in its hairiness, cold and thick. Kalamazoo, 1950s brick apartments, our dog Cassie was a fugitive, eerie white outside the kitchen window, a hot white indoors in a calming apartment in the treetops. Much time was spent in apartment with baby, surrounded by boxes, husband busy fixing toilets and other cubicles, doing wash at the super big spin-o-matic with my toddler, creeping across an icy parking lot to the next door, Sweetwater's donut shop. Donuts and coffee for depression, me, and for sugar tooth, her.
I so identify with that. So there are lots of things I could say about mothering, and unfortunately I'm not going to focus on the happy ones. And I feel a little guilty about that, especially after all of the sweet joys and concerns that the children shared this morning, because they are amazing. Let me give my disclaimer. If anyone tells my children what I say today, I will deny it, and I will claim that you are liars. So let me just get that out there. I love my children more than anyone else in this entire world. But if anyone had ever told me how hard mothering would be, I may have reconsidered. And not in the way that I wish my children away or wish they didn't exist, but maybe I would have thought about maybe hiring out the job to someone else. At first, and maybe still, I was reluctant, kind of like Jack the Cat. I felt like I had these babies around me yelling at me, feed me, feed me, feed me, and I could never seem to hide. I still can't. Babies and toddlers wear away at your ego like boot camp does to a young soldier. You don't really know what you're signing up for, and you can't really stop. The career that I left when Burke was born was a job that didn't fit my personality, but it rewarded me in ways that parenting did not. In my job, I got raises and reviews and feedback on my work. I was never yelled at or shit on or ignored like I was when I became a stay-at-home mom. I remember one night in particular when I was so tired, I just wanted them to go to sleep. And Indigo was three, and she was demanding to be read story after story. And I balanced Burke on my nap or on my lap, nursing him, trying to get him to go to sleep. And I just ended up sobbing through Sleeping Beauty over and over again. I was reading like a monotone robot, and I was angry. I was just wishing fiercely that my husband would get home from work to help me. I ate chocolate to cope. I got fat and tired and probably boring. But people kept giving me their unsolicited advice. Treasure every moment of it. It goes by so fast. Carpe diem. Thank you very much. Thanks, I know. Hearing that just makes me feel guilty. My shame in being a mother is that I don't enjoy every moment of it. Sometimes I even resent it. I mean, how could I not think highly of this job? Children are amazing. I love them. They're innocent and they're untainted and they're beautiful. And there's an enormous pressure that their fate rests in my hands. In this book that I picked up here in our used book sale a couple of months ago called Necessary Losses, the author writes about the mother's love. And let me find it. She says, "We fear that our imperfect love will harm our children. For unambivalent love, no strings attached love, so we believe, will foster our children's emotional well-being, saving them from drugs, depression, wretched relationships, injured self-esteem in spite of our almost uncountable failures and flaws. We trust that a mother's perfect love, no matter what else we may do, will send them armored into the cold, hard world. They will thrive because we love them. But what hope do they have if we sometimes feel anger or feel hate? In this list of reasons of why a mother could hate her baby, he says, "The baby is an interference with her private life. He is ruthless, treats her as scum, an unpaid servant, a slave. His excited love is cupboard love, so that having got what he wants, he throws her away like an orange peel. He is suspicious, refuses her good food, and makes her doubt herself, but eats well with his aunt. After an awful morning with him, she goes out, and he smiles at a stranger who says, 'Isn't he sweet?' My kids are easier now that they're in elementary school, and maybe part of it is because they're gone most of the day. But I feel like I just came out of a 10-year fog, and my world is just a shadow of before. The pieces of my former self lay around me like shrapnel, and I'm trying to pick through the pieces and find what's still intact. My identity, my career, my marriage, my friendships, everything has shifted. My new work that I'm seeing through some therapy and lots of talking and reading is not to resist this, but to embrace it. When I own it, I can enjoy it." Again, in this wonderful book by Brené Brown, she says, "Owning our story can be hard, but not nearly as difficult as spending our lives running from it. Embracing our vulnerabilities is risky, but not nearly as dangerous as giving up on love and belonging and joy, the experiences that make us the most vulnerable. Only when we are brave enough to explore the darkness will we discover the infinite power of our light."
The pathology of guilt and shame. As babies, toddlers, children, we need tender care. When we were genuinely loved, it felt good. When we were scolded, it felt bad. When we were ignored, it felt awful. When the people you depend on for your emotional, psychological, spiritual, and physical health ignore your innate needs, you suffer. No parent, grandparent, babysitter, child care provider is perfect. That goes without saying. When I was between the age of 4 and 6, my father realized I was different. He probably didn't know exactly why, but my bubbly personality that couldn't stop asking questions and wanting answers and wanting him to engage with me pushed him away. I can remember feeling different. I can remember learning that I could not depend on him to teach me anything, because it was I who could bring him to fury like nothing else. It was easier to learn on my own. As the knowledge that I was different grew, I feared that my differentness would cause me to lose all love and affection of my parents. I couldn't change who I was, but I could hide my enjoyment of playing with dolls. I didn't just learn to hide my true nature from my parents. I learned to hide it from other kids. I was taunted by others for being different. The early abuse by peers and the fear of rejection by my parents taught me that there was something about me that was disgusting, aberrant, and unlovable. To survive, I learned to become a kid who would be more acceptable to my parents, playmates, and teachers. I learned that I could become more popular by being more sensitive, that sounds odd but true, than other boys. I was the mediator between girls and boys. Those early infatuations with their wonderful twists and turns and topsy-turvy motion. I learned that my creativity could bring me much wanted approval. As I wrote skits that drew everyone into my world, I felt power and love. I could prove I was the smartest, or at least as smart as the smartest kids. Sometimes my eagerness to prove how smart I was caused great embarrassment. In our school, Union Ridge, there was no gym until sixth grade. And when that gym was done and the locker room was ready, the gym teacher brought all the sixth grade boys into the locker room and had everyone stand around him, and he asked, "Does anybody know what a supporter is, an athletic supporter is?" And I raised my hand quickly. I knew what it was. I said, "It's for people who have flat feet and need help with their arches." And there was such a wave of hysteria from the other boys just laughing and laughing. It felt like bullets ricocheting off those new lockers. I was so ashamed. My father was raised to be tough, stable, and emotionally detached. Moving into young adulthood during the Depression and as a soldier in World War II, he was well trained in stoicism. My father, by not knowing how to treat me, mostly avoided any interaction with me. I knew he loved me, but he felt so uncomfortable when he was with me. I felt invalidated by him. According to the gay psychologist Alan Downs in his book, The Velvet Rage, of all the invalidations we will receive in our lives, this by far the most damaging, when the father is incapable of validating us at a time when we need it most. It is emotional betrayal of the worst kind. My mother undoubtedly sensed I was different. She protected me from the slow and subtle betrayal of my father. She did what she could to compensate for the betrayal she saw me suffer. She validated the feminine ideals. She valued my feminine qualities. Psychologically, this made me comfortable, even drew me into the feminine, where I felt more at home. It helped me to grow in my ability to feel tender towards others and helped me develop an altruistic side. I had suffered rejection from my peers, emotional neglect from my father, and overcompensating protection from my mother. This makes one a puppet of sorts. My strings were manipulated by whomever I was around. If it was boys, I could talk about fishing, which I loved, or beat them at bowling or tennis. If it was men, I'd be quiet and tense, making sure mostly to keep my mouth shut. With women, I felt more relaxed and open. I allowed others to tell me who I was, pulling the strings, knowing that I couldn't trust others with whoever my true self was. I avoided behaviors which would make them shun me. Downs writes, "What would you like me to be? A great student? A minister? Mother's little man? The first chair clarinetist?" All of these I was. Gay men become dependent on adopting the skin our environment imposes on us to earn the love and affection we crave. How could we love ourselves when everything told us that we were unlovable? The ability to derive satisfaction and contentment didn't emerge from my adolescence as it should have. Instead, I sputtered along looking to others for confidence and well-being that I needed to protect myself from being overcome by shame. While I had plenty of friends, many of them who were boys, I never felt I could really reveal my true self. I was always patterning myself in ways which I thought would make me acceptable. I sought refuge in books, gardening, and nature. These activities prompted an and provided the room for self-examination. It has been said that the unexamined life is not worth living. And I know that my life unexamined would not have been livable. I have worked most of my life to understand who I am. What are the causes of depression, anger, irritability, low self-esteem? Now that I am at the threshold of becoming an elder, I appreciate most of the time, not all the time, these difficult gifts. And sometimes what felt impossible, I appreciate the toughness it has brought me to understand. It has cultivated a deep appreciation for the healing properties of art, how it opens the heart to beauty in many forms. It's brought me deep into the love of flowers, trees. It asks me to understand how I fit in the ecosystem. What role do I play? And how should I be in right relationship with all living beings? Being connected to the natural order of things opened my heart to all of life, the mystery of the linkages, and to the great love for the earth, this galaxy, and the cosmos. Am I free of guilt and shame? No. They still have power in my life, as I imagine they still have power in every life in this room. But I am better equipped to refuse the messages of unworthiness. Instead, I try to choose those ways of seeing myself which brings balance and supple strength to my being. It allows me to feel acutely the pain of others who suffer. Empathy is a great gift. It offers its 360 degrees of blessing. The more narrow and rigid the accepted norms are in a culture, and the greater the imbalance of power, bullies thrive. Bullies rule. The push to be aligned with the bullies, if you cannot be one, is strong. Just look at what happened around the world when there are absolute military dynasties that without even thinking lop off a hand or a foot. Who wants to be one of those people? Who wants to have a limb lopped off? Where there is fear, you often find imbalance. We each need to explore how guilt and shame works in our lives so that we do not inadvertently harm others and so that we can have the greatest access to self and universal love. The more access people have to power, the more evenly it is distributed, the less violence and abuse is tolerated. The need to exert control over others lessens. The more you have control over yourself and know yourself, the more you live out of your true nature. And that is the very best gift you can give yourself and the world. Religion often uses guilt and shame to control people. As a Unitarian Universalist, I hope that this congregation, this great community, understands the incredible responsibility of not bringing shame to anyone, of not using guilt to get what you want. To allow yourselves to be open and vulnerable and supply strong, to give the true gift of self, which links us all to this great and beautiful cosmos. So Kim and Katie, why don't you come up? We have some time for sharing. We really wanted to hear what others have to say about how they have found guilt and shame works in their lives and how they have learned to use it wisely. or if you just have something you would like to share in that realm of guilt and shame, or the lack of it.
Hi, I'm Kathy Hedge, and I want to thank you all. This is very, very touching, so thank you very much for sharing your stories. And yes, let's see. I guess, you know, there's lots of things that I can look back in the past and go, gee, why did I do that? You know, and just hate it. But I'll tell you what, for those of you who are younger, one of the very best things about getting older is you can say, I am what I am. And that's wonderful to just be who we are. And I just wish we could get that at a much, much younger age. That doesn't mean that you tromp all over people who are around you, but that you yourself are beautiful just exactly the way you are.
Stacey Brofman, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that probably most of us feel that way when we're raising our children. And you know, I'm still fairly new to, you know, Unitarian fellowship. And, you know, it's funny because I see you guys and you're so patient listening to your children when they have the mic and when they're up there. And you know, I imagine you, you know, singing songs to them every night and weaving their pillowcases. And I'm thinking, And, you know, and I always just wished I had a copy of that book, Go the Fuck to Sleep, you know, that came out. Yes. And so it's just, you know, I think that it's so hard that we, when we compare our insides to other people's outsides, and we all come up short with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I tell you what, last night I had a really, really good night. My children are grown. My baby girl is 21 years old now. And the thing that was really nice is even though I worked their whole life as a single mother pretty much, the one thing that my daughter wanted to do for her birthday was to come over and have me make homemade shepherd's pie. And, you know, so, and they're okay. You know, they're okay, even though I was a stressed out, full of shame mother. They're alive. I'm alive. No scars, I don't think. And but anyway, thank you very much.
Gene Severs. I'm very, very thankful for second chances because without them, there couldn't be third and fourth and 19th and 37th chances.
Michael Oldfather, I don't know how many other males in the room have had at least a stint of being a house husband. Mine was thankfully not long, but I did it, and I found a lot about it. It made some sense as I was putting my last 2 years of residency in graduate school. My first wife got a pretty demanding job, and so But I had a lot of flexibility so that I could be there when she wasn't and do things with the children who were, oh, 2 and 8, I guess, 9. Anyway, I'm thinking about this. Was it a cat that took care of these eggs? About imprinting. One day I was working in the kitchen, and my son, Paul, who was about 2 and a half, came in, and Paul had a bit of a hearing loss that was later corrected, but it made him talk very loud. And he was, I don't know where he got this, but he was just macho as all get out. He didn't get it from me, but he got it someplace. And he came storming into the kitchen where I was preparing the dinner, and he said, we're going to play house, and I'm going to be the daddy. Where's the apron? Because I was the only person he had ever seen with an apron, I'm going to leave out the parts that I particularly did poorly in that era. I just as soon have them be forgotten and certainly not known and shared.
Well, I was touched, Michael, to hear about your relationship with your father. It was almost exactly my experience with my father, only it was not because I was different in the same way, but because my father, just to give you an example, my mother told me many years later that when my father was pregnant with my older brother, my mother was pregnant with my older brother, my father informed her that it better be a boy. Because no children of his were going to have an older sister. No boys of his were going to have to go through what he went through, having an older sister. And so that was his basic attitude towards females in general. And yes, I felt not good enough, and I felt as though when I was bubbly and asking questions, that was not acceptable, and that that was being pushed away. Questions, you know, so the relationship was the same. And I could go on, but I'll stop here.
Hi, my name is Jody, and I have a 19-year-old and I have a 9-year-old. Two very different worlds. I know my mom always told me that she would rather raise 20 boys to one girl. And I never understood it, and then I had my boy, and then I had my girl, and now I understand why. With my boy and my girl there, you know, you feel guilt and you feel shame because you may have given one more to the other than not, or, you know, whatever those feelings are that you feel on an everyday basis with your children. And then you always get that, well, they had a better life than I did. Okay. All right. Well, you know, sometimes your guilt is deep. Sometimes your shame is deep. Sometimes it is not. It is superficial. And I had a lovely example, and I will take this kind of a guilt when one day my daughter was talking to another adult, and she said something about to the fact that, well, if I would have done that, my mom would have just smacked me upside my head. Well, the lady turned to her and said, well, why would your mother have smacked you upside your head if you did that? And my daughter just so proudly said, well, she wants to make sure that common sense is still in my head. You know, so on that level, when I looked at her, I was like, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but the values that I know that I'm instilling in her and the fact that she, you know, has this common sense or the, you know, the heart, you know, and the ways to get there may or may not be good, but it's still, I'll take it because I know in the end the nurturing to her when I sit with her and she's got to be up on me, I know that I'm doing right and I will take that kind of guilt if that's what it means for her.
Lindsay Smith, I'm Katie's husband, and I'm so grateful that we have Ruby and Iris, that they have an older sister, younger sister, but for me, I'm grateful to have daughters. I grew up with three brothers, and it was quite a probably different experience, but I love my sister-in-laws, you know, one of my older brothers. I grew up with their wives, and so it's better for me to have daughters. I learned so much more, I think. Makes me a better person.
Thank you guys for sharing, especially Kim. I try not to cry. I can definitely understand where you're coming from. I just went from having a very social job to this, and I love it to death, but it's hard sometimes. So thank you for sharing.
My name is Sylvia Beeman, and when I had my first child, I still was struggling mightily to be exceptional at my job. And I was in an excellent virology lab and hoped to finish my PhD
and I had a little girl, and I was trying to be an exceptional mother. And then my second baby died, and it completely changed my life. I know I felt a lot of guilt that, why did that happen to me? And if I had been home and been a more taking better care of myself, maybe that wouldn't have happened, although probably none of those things are true. But after that, I totally devoted myself to being an exceptional mom, and I went on to have two more girls, and I have to say, my daughters are fantastic, and we love girls, and there are always tons of boys around our house, always, from ever, so we sort of had lots of boys, too, so anyway, but I tried so hard to be a great mother, but the other women in the neighborhood actually made fun of us. My girls were really talented and smart and pretty. I mean, they just are. And they, one of the moms always made fun of us and called us the Von Trapps because my kids were a little musical. And then I remember another friend joyously told me that all the soccer moms were laughing because one of the perfect beaming girls had dyed her hair green. But sometimes, I mean, a long time later, I realized that I had benefited from having a very harsh and often cruel mother, because from when I was two, I knew there was something very unusual about my mother, and I learned to have a secret self. And so I have always had my secret self that gives me, validates me, and tells me that I don't have to depend on what other people think of me outside. And another thing saved me, and my art self opened to me, and over the years I've become an artist. And I know when I go to my shows, I see some people are really shocked. They think some of my artwork is really disturbing. But that is my saving activity, that I can express myself that way, and actually I get a lot of pleasure out of that. And I just have to tell this other thing. Once my husband and I were in Walmart, and we had probably just our one child screaming her head off. And one of Dick's coworkers, who was older, came up to us and said, "I know you think this is really hard and embarrassing and bad, but it'll only get worse." And, and actually, I really appreciate your honesty about being a parent, because it is so really hard. And Dick and I looked at each other in our stupidity and naivety a couple years ago, and Dick said, "We'll never be done being parents, will we?" And our perfect little beaming girls, who actually it was a breeze when they were in diapers and bratty youngsters, they've had lots of problems, really adult problems, and it will never be over. I mean, now we know that. But we'll all be in there fighting it together with all the rest of humanity. And Michael, I wish I had been your friend when you were a little boy. I would have just adored you. And I'm so glad you're in our church now. I've benefited from knowing you so many ways.
Sybil Perkins, I grew up with the perfect mom. Or I thought. And she couldn't possibly have been as perfect as I remember. And how nice it would have been to know her vulnerabilities and her doubts. I never saw that. She was perfect. So I expected that of myself. And I happen to have two boys who, for different reasons, were very inconsolable as infants, and how incredibly powerless is that, and shameful is that, if you cannot calm your baby, if you cannot comfort your baby. That's what mothering is. So I really appreciate your honesty. Like Stacy said, how that's the beauty of this group, is we get to see each other's insides. And I wanted to share a comforting thought that I would go to later when after I heard this person. I'm sure you all know Roseanne Barr and how edgy she was. Well, I heard her say once, and it just lifted all the weight off my shoulders. She said, If my kids are alive, when my husband gets home, I've done my job. So, there you go.
All right. We have time for a quick one more, okay?
Oh, no.
No, go ahead, Edith. No, please.
Well, my second, I have three boys, three men. When my second son was born, he was born with cerebral palsy. We were, I guess at that point, I felt a tremendous amount of guilt that I had birthed a child who was not perfect. And after a while, I suddenly realized that this child was perfect in his own way. He is 54 now. Lives on his own. He is in a wheelchair, you know, an electric wheelchair. But he works, and he has his own apartment. And I look back, and I think, my husband and I were able to get him to that point of being an absolute individualist, of being his own man. It took a long time to get rid of the guilt and the shame of having an imperfect child. But now all I have is tremendous, tremendous pride that this guy is my son.
So, let us now stand and sing our closing hymn number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day.
I'd like to offer you a definition of Mother's Day, and this definition comes from Stephanie Kuntz, family historian and scholar from Evergreen State University, who happened to be in Manhattan this week. Maybe some of you caught her speaking. The fact is that Mother's Day originated to celebrate organized activities of mothers outside the home. The people who inspired Mother's Day believed that motherhood was a political force. Mother's Day only became trivialized and commercialized after its meaning was confined to a woman's special role within the family.
Before my father died, we had become very, very, very close. The consciousness of one's inner value is anchored in higher, more spiritual things, and ultimately, as you mature, no one can take it away.
May we all have the courage to embrace our imperfections and share our stories so that we may live in love with our whole hearts.